Accession number 12197, Reel 2.
Ernest Tompkins, Reel 2. So you're coming back from Hampstead with all the medical records.
We had all the records. Now, I wanted to see it as much as the others, you know. So it was a corridor train, as it happens, as far as I remember. It was either that or the station. I'm not sure whether I got out at the station. No, I don't know. I'm not sure it was a corridor. At any rate, I got out. And, of course, these records was with my coach, you know. They had a look at it while I was out, so they knew how they'd got on. I was pleased to know. But it was temporary unfit. That was my record, temporary unfit. Pending the removal of tonsils. So I had to take 10 up to Lewisham General Hospital to have their tonsils out. And I had a photograph of that, and like an idiot, that photograph I showed you about that crashed aeroplane, I sent to Michael Young. You know that man? He's to do with the Air Crew Association.
Yeah.
Well, when I found that that picture was published, I thought he'd think I was conning him, you know. So I sent him, as a make-weight, I sent this photograph of us at Lewisham. I should have taken a copy of it. And there was, I'm pretty sure it was 10 of us went up, have our tonsils out. Well, after that, that was the end of Hastings. Of course, I came to Bristol. Now, I'll tell you a story about Bristol. That was a very compact, efficient school of aeronautics. If you knew Bristol, we had aeroplanes in the Victoria Rooms and Art Gallery. We had engine running in the artillery grounds. And I was billeted in the Grange at Woodland Road. It was quite a big corner house. It was very efficient. Now, the first lecture we had was on the Clergy 110 horsepower rotary. And the man giving the lecture was a Frenchman. Otherwise, he was from the French factory. I remember him walking into that room. He put his hat, his stick, his coat, and his gloves on the table. Very deliberately. And he came to the front of the stage. He said, "I'm the engine merchant." Well, now that put us at our ease, you know. He was down to earth. And he gave a lecture on the Clergy aero engine. Now, I hope you'll believe this, Brad, because it really did happen. How much truth there was on the French side of it, I don't know. But at any rate, at the end of the lecture, he said, "Any questions?" And don't forget, I'd done a lot of studying on rotary engines and all. "Any questions?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "What is the question?" "Well," I said, "this engine, I understand, is rated 110 horsepower." "Quite right." I said, "Was that designed to produce 110 horsepower? Or was that a bonus?" Because I said, "The Dome and the New Rome companies are each producing 100 horsepower. This is before the modern ones, eh?" I said, "You come along with 110 horsepower, seeing it was all about the same time, did you design that?" Well, of course, that caused a snicker. You quite understand that. They thought the bloke's crazy. This Frenchman said, "What an extraordinary question," he said. He said, "I don't know what made you ask me this," but he said, "You're perfectly right. It was designed," he said, "for 100 horsepower. Now," he said, "they had to get down to do some research and find out why they were getting 10 horsepower more than they bargained for. And during the search, they found that the draftsman had located the gudgeon pin bosses slightly farther down the skirt of the piston than he should have done. The result of that was it pushed the piston up and gave a higher compression ratio. Gives them another 10 horsepower. Would you think that was right?
Oh, it sounds fantastic. I mean, I know you're right. But
that's what he told us.
Good gracious.
So it wasn't a silly question as it happened. Something you could tell me, you know. Well, then I went to Oxbridge.
So just to recap, up until this time, you were still considered a cadet officer, were you?
Not then. No. I wasn't up there.
Right.
That was only at Hastings.
Right.
It wasn't a very big school, Bristol wasn't. Mm. That wasn't any more than, I don't think they all went to Bristol from Hastings. I wouldn't think that the whole school had any more than 40 or 50 cadets.
So were you still wearing a private's uniform?
I was still wearing the cadet uniform, look.
Right.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so I was given as soon as I went to Hastings, I was given the RFC cadet uniform then, look.
And you carried that with you again to Bristol?
That's right.
Yeah,
and
right.
That was like you saw me on the picture thing.
So you'd done your basic officer's training at Hastings.
That's right.
On
the flying side of it.
So you'd learnt how to use a knife and fork in Hastings, and now they'd moved you on to aeronautical training at Bristol.
Machine guns is the only thing really that really counted, say, in map reading. All the rest was dry stuff, military law, that sort of thing, you know.
Mm.
You can't imagine these pilot officers having to do military law these days, can you? When I got to Oxbridge, I'll show you this later on, but anyway, I got to Oxbridge. The instructor said one day, he said, I want you to go down on the range and do your drill. He said, I'll have the vicar's gun set up for you, and I'll let you know when to start. Boy, I was picked, I don't know. But anyway, I put on flying gear. Said good suit, thigh boots, three pairs of gloves, helmet, all that kind of stuff. And I tucked myself into this universal cockpit. Otherwise, you have a control that as you move the machine guns attached to the drums, see? So you have to move the lot, just if you're moving an aeroplane. And in the distance, there's these like silhouettes of aircraft coming at various angles, which you had to shoot at. And they always, I pretty well always, put a blank in. Now, if you put a blank in, you get a stoppage. Otherwise, you've got no recall. So I was tucked into this thing, and a voice said, carry on. I carried on. And then I waited, and nothing was happening. And I saw them disappear in the distance. And that was the end of that. I wouldn't have thought any more about it. The instructor said, I had some visitors today. And he said, do you know who they were? I said, no. But he said, excuse me. He said, one was H.M. King George the Fifth. So I was set up for that. And I think a lot of the reason was, I'm sure I was this rifle club, you know. Well, from Hastings, from Oxbridge, I went up to Wittering. When I arrived there, as far as I remember, I was only one. I don't know, I think I had any companions. When I arrived there, the CO said, he showed me my billet, and I had a cup of tea. He said, of course, you've never been to Wittering, have you? I said, no, sir. That's about a couple of miles away from Stamford. And he goes like this, and no time at all, a Panther motorbike arrived. He carries me up there, you know. I want you, sonny. And this Panther motorbike took me up to the aerodrome. And there was a Captain Barton there met me. And I was having a chat. He said, "You new here?" I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Would you like a bit of air experience?" "Oh, of course I would, you know." And I had that air experience. And I thought that was marvelous stuff.
So was this the first time you'd ever been in an aeroplane?
That was the first time. And I'd never... of course, that was... I don't know what my show. That was in a... I think it was in a BE, took me up there. Saying, of course, I'd never been in an aeroplane before, obviously. But I was thrilled with that. But the next day, of course, I turned up there and I was posted, probably posted. Look. And I was treated very well, there's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. I had three air experiences, and then a Lieutenant Bonin took me up three or four times. And Captain McFarlan took me up. That's three instructors in no time at all. And I went on solo.
So this was a part of your formal flying training.
Yes.
Whittering. Mm. Yeah. Were you conscious of any organisation to your training, or was it fairly haphazard?
No, only this rifle club. That's all. Now, I must tell you this, because I'm not sure whether I put it in my records, but close to my home, there was an airplane at a forced landing. Even in those days, I think I'm right in saying it was a Coanda designed. Coanda was the designer, do you know about that? And it had a green engine. Now, you can correct me on this if I'm wrong. It was the green engine, I think, had a flywheel. A counterbalance the prop. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure it was the green engine, because this had a flywheel, so I said it was, I thought it was a green engine, see. And the chap went to ring up the aerodrome and allowed me to get in the cockpit and work the controls. And I didn't know that he was watching when he got back. And I was doing what I knew I had to do, like, and he said, "You know a little bit about aeroplanes, don't you?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You'll fly one day." I never thought I would, though. But he was watching the controls, you know, watching me go through the movements. See? At any rate, I'll have a break a minute. I'll have a drink.
So, Ennis, you were about 4 months at Hastings.
Yes.
From September 17.
That's right.
And then you went on to... Bristol in February of 1918.
Yes.
And then your records show that you went up to Uxbridge in May.
That's right.
Where you did your training there.
Was it as late as that, May?
19th of May, 1918.
Well, when did I go to Whittering that night?
Well, you would have done that... it looks here, so it says September... Is that about right?
No, I spent three or four months at Whittering, mine.
Mm. Well, it says you were at the flying school between the time you left Uxbridge up to about September 1918.
Yeah, of course, I didn't do any flying there, see.
No.
When I arrived at what was Sedgeford, we used to call it Bertram Newton, Sedgeford. This Major Wynne Wilson was there. Now, as I told you, I think I was getting some good treatment. Because when I arrived at Sedgeford, Major Wynne Wilson was there. Now, he's the CO at Hastings, an elderly man. So he certainly wasn't the CO there. And they don't have two majors on the same squadron. So I can only assume he came up to send me out to France, because when I arrived there, he said, Bristol. He said, "You've been hanging around, haven't you?" I said, "I've enjoyed my flying, sir." He said, "Good. How would you like to go to France?" I said, "I think that is the general idea, sir." He said, "This is entirely in your interest, and I strongly advise you to accept my offer." Now, how did he know that I was going to be there? So I mean,
yeah, it's very odd.
I was monitored, obviously, and I didn't go to a pilot's pool, which would have been Marquis. It used to be Santa Maria, but I think that time it was Marquis, which is quite a bigger place. I went to a small aerodrome at Wisson. As you will see in the records, the CO, Captain Slutter, he said, I would like to have a look at the country. Well, I said I would. So I took up one of these DH-9s that he had there. Really, I suppose I'd going a little bit too far ahead because I hadn't done much flying in that DH-9. I only graduated at it, see. Perhaps I ought to go back and tell you about that. I was flying DH-6s, B-2Es. We did our stunting on a B-2D, if you were allowed to stunt, and on an RE-8. I did my compass course on an Armstrong Whitworth. That's in the logbook, see. And then, of course, they must have borrowed a DH-9, because this was an RTOB squadron. We didn't fly DH-9s there. They must have borrowed a DH-9 for me to graduate in. So the only flying on a DH-9 that I'd done was my graduation, which was about 7 hours.
At Uxbridge.
I had one day, you know. I came down to Gloucester and all that sort of thing. So when I went to France, I'd only done a very limited amount of flying on DH-9. And I went up this DH-9, and the following day I took up 3 Americans. And that, I haven't mentioned passenger, but you will see it, the times, in my logbook. So Captain Slatter said, would I take up these 3 Americans? And I'll never forget. One was, always reminds me of Sergeant Bilko. Quite a nice fella, chatty. A bit loud, you know, but he was a type, Sergeant Bill, good type, and I thought, well, I'll give him a special treat. He was the last. And I took him up to 10,000 feet and went up to Newport, which is the end of the lines. I think he was a bit scared. He had no ammunition, see. So I brought him back. Later on in the evening, they were stood around waiting for dinner. You know, as they do, having a drink and a chat, waiting for dinner. And my words was, I ambled up to this crowd. There was the CO and the Yanks and a few there. And I walked up. And the CO was stood next to me. He said, look, he said, if you want to get, this is the very words he used, if you want to get shot up the crack, he said, that's okay by me. But not in my machine, he said. And he went like that, see. The Yank complained that I took him too near the lines because he had no ammunition. The CO was a bit amused about it, see. And then I went up up to Berg. Now, I'm going to tell you, this is one of those stories, something like my brother, meeting my brother, which was a coincidence. Now, here's a very strange coincidence. When I was at Hastings, a seaplane, a short seaplane, was forced down on the water with engine trouble. And the pilot managed to get the machine close inshore. Well, I'd been, my job, of course, I was a good group leader, had to help this man out, this pilot out, by... He had to phone up the aerodrome for assistance, and I entertained him and gave him some refreshments, you know. And I saw that, looked at that seaplane, and I thought, I'd love to be with that squadron, wherever it is. And I saw this naval pilot, you know, I thought, oh, that's just what I wanted. oh, well, there. I thought, I'm in the RFC and that's it. And it's the next best thing anyway. See? So, coming back to this DH9, at 10 o'clock, this is at Wisconsin, at 10 o'clock, Captain Slatter said, your tender's arrived. I didn't know anything about a tender. And I got in this tender, they had a bed and all fixed up for me to travel overnight up to Berg by Dunkirk. I was getting some very good treatment, I had the bed and all fixed up. And we arrived there about 6 o'clock in the morning. And Major Gow was there. He must have got up early anyway. And introduced himself, you know, and he said, you haven't been flying DH4s, have you? I said, no, sir. He said, I'll get Captain Biles to give you a briefing. He'll be your flight commander. So he sent for Captain Biles. And I looked at Captain Biles, her in his uniform. Gosh. And I looked at his face. And we shook hands. I thought, well, this is Mission Impossible. RNAS. I couldn't credit it, you know. Mission Impossible. So we shook hands and held hands and looked at each other. I said, we're thinking the same thing, aren't we? We've met before. He said, we have. I said, weren't you the pilot who was forced down on the water off Hastings? Yes. Well, I said, I'm the cadet that you have to handle your business. That made my day, and he was my flight commander. Can you imagine that, Brad? That's 12 months later. I go to the out of all the squadrons, I go to the very squadron I said I wish I was with that squadron. Mm. It's remarkable.
Why is it that you wanted to join the Royal Naval Air Service rather than the Flying Corps?
Well, no, that's a good question. I often wondered that myself. Whether it was the uniform or the aeroplanes themselves, I can't be sure. I think it's a bit of both.
I mean, had you been reading Flight and Aeroplane about members of the...
I read a lot about flying boats and all that, you know, like float planes. So I think a lot to do with that.
Were you a bit upset that you were actually drafted into the Royal Flying Corps?
I was, of course I was, in the first place. It didn't make all that difference, actually. I was amongst aeroplanes, that's all that mattered. Yeah. But I was a bit disappointed that I had to go in the Flying Corps as opposed to the RNAS. But as it turned out, the training in the RNAS in the Flying Corps was far better than the RNAS, you see. Much better. You'll see that from the records, look.
As a young man during the war, had you been hearing stories from the front about people like Albert Ball or McCudden, or was it...
Yes, I suppose a bit of both. I read all the books I could get hold of, you know. But I don't know why. The only connection, my father, he wanted to carry on his trade in the merchant service. And it was my mother. He was courting my mother at the time. She persuaded him against it. But he was keen on going afloat, you know. But I don't think I could have stood too much of that. Talking about that, I haven't come as far as that yet. But at any rate,
how did you react in the middle of your training when you found that the Royal Flying Corps had been amalgamated with the Royal Naval Air Service?
If you read that article, Pearson's. Of course, they were snooty. And they took it very badly because they were the as you can tell, they were on the top squadron. But as far as I'm concerned, it didn't matter to Hoots. I mean, I was flying aeroplanes, and that's all that mattered. Mm. So, I mean, you still become the fleet air arm. Look, it didn't make a lot of difference. Mm. I mean, it's only a difference in name, that's about all. You're in the RAF, but you are the fleet air arm. As you know, they're still like 202 squadron doing search and rescue, that sort of thing. So I should have still been kept as on the Navy side of it.
So it didn't really make any difference to you because you were amongst aeroplanes and you were as happy as a sandboy.
That was the main thing. Of course, there's lots of things that comes to my memory, but I remember once when I had the exhaust manifold fall off. That was up. It's in the
log. You noted that in your log, didn't you?
Yeah. But that didn't cause any problem because it came down on the port side. We do anti-clockwise circuits. And I just got up and turned around, and this thing fell off and it had a long pipe on it, and it just lodged down on the bottom plane up against the wire end, see. And it wasn't until I'd actually lost all speed that it begins to settle down. But, of course, I cut my engine off dead. I had to do that so as not to get the prop tangled up. But, I don't think it made a lot of difference to me, whether it was RFC or RNAS. But they were, they fancied their chance a bit, you know.
How many hours did you graduate with when you got your wings? How many hours did you have in your logbook when you got your wings?
Well, by today's standards, it was very little. Now, if you notice, I did about 100 hours flying at Wittering. I did about almost 60 hours solo flying at Wittering, and I did quite a lot of dual seat. And of course, I did an hour or two out at Wissant. The rest was at, I don't suppose I did any more, about 50 hours altogether out at, in France at Wissant. Of course, that's a long time in those days.
Did you have any combat training in England?
No, we didn't have to, look.
So that was pure yeah. flying training?
Yeah, that's what I had to do. I had a job to do, look. Now, these chutes, I explained in the cassette, I think it did, how they do chutes with the clock code. Do you know anything about chutes? Do you know how to do chutes?
Not personally, no, but I'd like to hear
the
you.
The clock code? And
well, and we know about the clock code. You tell me how you used to operate it.
That's it. The photography, of course, they did a lot of photography work, see. But I will, I mention this, on my first flight, here I get in an aeroplane I've never flown before, but it didn't happen on my first flight, what I'm going to tell you. It was my first active service flight. That is, we were on a Dawn reconnaissance, I think it was. We were climbing up through the clouds. We knew it's only a bank of clouds, you had to climb up above. And the engine gave a cough. And, of course, I realized straight away I hadn't switched over from the pressure gravity tank to the pressure tank. And I didn't lose my position or anything like that, but I did it instantaneously. But when you do that, you fill your gravity tank for emergency. You have to switch that off as well, or else you can pump it over your top plane, see. Different the goings on today, isn't it? It's like the station commander at Wittering said, when I caught all of the parachute straps, he said, you know, the parachute. I said, we didn't have any of that. What? He said. I said, we didn't have parachutes. Did you? What did you do? Well, I said, you had the option. You had three options. I said, sit there and roast. I said, if you're Petrotank on fire, of course you sit there and roast. I said, or you could jump out. That wasn't pleasant. Or I said, you had a revolver there, you could blow your brains out. So you could pick, have your pick.
So at least they gave you a choice.
That's a bad pick, wasn't it? I had a... And it's in the logbook. I think I was a bit satisfied with my achievement. I had an elderly man, this is after the war, see. An elderly man came to me, Akema. He said, could you give me a flight, Mr. Tompkins? Well, I said, you're not in our flight, are you? He said, no, sir. I said, you're in Captain Bailey's flight. He said, yeah. Well, I said, well, you're going to ask Captain Bailey. Well, it's like this, sir, he said. I've got a wife and four children at home. He said, I've always been too scared to have a flight or even ask for one. But he said, I was talking to, and he mentioned the names, talking to these chaps, he said, and they said, I'd be perfectly safe with you. Oh, I said, you'll be safe with any of them here. He said, I said, I know what you mean. You want me to give you the same flight as the others had? Yes, sir. He said, that's it. See? Now, what he was scared, I'd just take him up and throw the plane around. He didn't.